Good evening. So we have a few questions tonight. I will tell you that I have a handful of questions remaining. I'm going to finish out those questions that I have, and then I'm going to move on to something else. So probably have a few more weeks of this series. So I'm officially closing off the submissions. Haven't received any in a little while. So, but if you sent it in and it's on my list, I'm getting to it. So. I will be glad to answer whatever questions come, and I do appreciate them. Usually, if one person has a question, more than one person has that question, and it's just good to, it's helpful to me also to just know what people are thinking about in our church. Where are people coming from? And so I appreciate this a lot, and I've enjoyed this. So I have a few questions to answer tonight, and these will be fairly concise, each of these. The first one is, I think, a relevant question, and it is perhaps one that, you know, you might have various political pundits that are make it a contentious issue, but the question I'm just going to answer from a theological standpoint is, do the Israelites or present-day Jews have a perpetual claim to the physical promised land? And so I'm going to answer this theologically. In my way of thinking, the modern Jewish state is not a direct corollary with the Israelite nation in the first century. There is enough evidence. I mean, the Jews were dispersed for many, many, many centuries, and even although there are a lot of similarities in bloodlines, and you can definitely trace them back to a degree, there was also a lot of intermarrying that happened, and so the particular people group that once was is not what is now. And I'm simply going to answer this the way that Jesus answered it. So Jesus, in Matthew chapter 23, when he was getting ready to leave the world, Jesus looked out over Jerusalem. He said, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that stones the prophets and kills those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered you together as a hen gathers her chicks, but you were not willing. Therefore, I tell you, your house is left to you desolate." And Jesus looked at his apostles and he said, "You see, this temple over here," and he said, "I tell you, there will not be one stone left on top of another, but all of it will be destroyed." Jesus, there about 40 years prior to, so one whole generation prior to what happened, Jesus was prophesying about what would happen in AD 70 when the Romans would come in and literally destroyed Jerusalem, which was not just a historical event. It was a prophetic event, and it was a theological event. This was the judgment of God on the house of Israel, where there was a permanent removal of that group in particular as being his people, and then there was the ushering in of a new age where God's people were not limited, or you know, it was not particularly the Jewish people, but it was for everybody. And so the answer to the question, is there a perpetual claim? From a theological standpoint, I would say no. Now, if you want to get into opinions about the Jewish state, I believe that God probably has a particular disdain for Hamas and these various groups that are very wicked in their ideology. And so I would say, just from a practical standpoint, the position over there is better than it would be alternatively if there was not an ally on that end. But theologically, the answer is no. Another reason why I say that is because the sons of Abraham, per the initial prophecies, so the initial prophecy made to Abraham was not one that primarily concerned Israel as a nation forever, but God made his promises to just one. And Paul makes a big deal about this in his writings, that the prophecies and the promises were made that there would be one that was the rightful heir. And Israel is somewhat of a microcosm. So God always works from the smaller things to the greater things, from the particular to the general. And Whereas God initially gave his people a very small sliver of land there in ancient Israel, God's intention was not that the king would perpetually and eternally have a throne in Jerusalem in that little land, but that Jesus reigning from heaven would have all of the world. So we're not concerned with one small sliver now, but really the entire world. This is what Jesus meant when he said, "Now all authority is mine, go disciple all of the nations." And the sons of Abraham were always the children of faith, not the children of the bloodline. Paul makes a big deal about this in Romans. So you can read Romans chapter 4, Romans chapter 9, 10, and 11. Go read Galatians chapter 3. Paul makes the broad point that the children of Abraham are not those who have his blood, but those who share his faith. The promise was made to Abraham by faith. It was not a child of the flesh. The child of the flesh was who? Ishmael. Okay? But Isaac was the promise that came by faith. And you and I, we are sons of Abraham if we share that faith. We're grafted in just as miraculously as Isaac was born. God made this miracle baby happen to a couple that was nearly 100 years old and blessed the whole world eventually through them, through Jesus Christ. So, theologically, the answer is no. And again, we have to learn to see the Bible as a whole. There are types and anti-types, and the same stories repeated over and over again. And one of the things that you see, even while God was concerned primarily with Israel in the Old Testament, you see indications that, oh, God's not just concerned with this little sliver. God is concerned also with these other places. You remember Jonah. Where was Jonah sent? He was sent to ancient Assyria. He was sent to Nineveh. And he went there indicating that God cares about these people. And those people in that generation became the people of God, because what did they do? They turned to God. They repented and they said, "We're sorry, God. We have been sinning against you." And you see little glimmers through the Old Testament where God is showing, "I'm interested with the whole world. This interest right now in this small group is for a time, for a purpose, until the one to whom the promises had been made comes, and then the whole world would be blessed." So, for the Israelite nation, they got this little sliver. The church proper gets the entire world. And this is why Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." We are the rightful heirs of the entire earth, every last bit of it. It should all be taken for Jesus. He's not going to set up a throne in Israel. Now, dispensationalism, you probably see a lot of this stuff online. The dispensational theology, I'm going to talk about this in our Daniel series, but it is a misunderstanding of many biblical prophecies that speak about the things which were to come, which have already come. But we do see at Pentecost that God was concerned with all of the nations. And what they do? They took the gospel back to their nations. We see with Paul, who said, "I'm done with the Jews. I'm going now to the Gentiles because they will listen to me." And so they'd be grafted in. We see this in the book of Daniel, where Daniel causes a pagan king to become a worshiper of God, who declared that God is the one true God and there's only one God. Nebuchadnezzar ultimately said that, which is so staggering that that happened and that he declared this over all the world. That is a precursor for Christianity, that Nebuchadnezzar would say that, and that eventually Darius would say that, and that the world would be blessed through all of these people. There's a reason why Paul wanted the gospel to go to the house of Caesar. Let's get it to the top. Christians everywhere. We're not just concerned with one spot, but with the whole world. So, no, I don't believe that theologically the Israelites have a claim any longer to modern-day Israel. Now, the situation as it is right now, I do believe, is better than the alternative. Hamas is a particularly terrible group, and it is good in that wild part of the world to have some alliances. Feel free to have your opinions on that. Second question tonight, what does the Bible say about tattoos and piercings? This was submitted by a younger person. I think that it is relevant and it's a good question. And, you know, one of the things, maybe you've recognized this as we've gone through this series, that there are so many matters for which God does not give, He does not legislate a direct yes, no, do this, don't do this. And yet, there are certainly principles that we must be mindful of when we consider these kinds of things. I don't think that it is a good thing to make a permanent change to one's self without thinking through the implications and those matters very seriously. The Bible doesn't legislate. It doesn't give an absolute this or that. And so that is on each person to do it. And I do think that there's something, I think it's interesting that God is not a micromanager. He's a good father. He's not a helicopter parent. There are some parents that they want to tell their kids, you know, even once they're older, you can't do this, you can't do that, you have to do everything exactly like this. God oftentimes provides us with wisdom, and He says, take this, go and be wise. So these are the three things that I would say. The church has no legislation on this. God did not give an absolute this way or that way on this. But these are three things that the Bible does clearly say that I think we should consider very seriously. Number one, we should consider that our body is not our own. So 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 through 20, we know He's not just talking about some ethereal spiritual body. He's talking about the physical body because He said that the person who joins himself to a prostitute actually sins against his own body because they became one flesh together. So He's talking about the physical body, 1 Corinthians 6, 19 through 20, and He simply says, your body is not your own. So whatever we do with it, we must consider that fact. My body is not my own, it belongs to God, and so I'm going to prayerfully consider God's will regarding everything that I do with it. I'll save this other statement for just a minute from now, but we certainly know that we are prohibited from mutilating our bodies and defacing and desecrating the image of God which is impressed upon us. And so that's something to guide us. Another, a second principle to guide us, I have three of them. The second one is that God does repeatedly warn against excessive attention drawn to ourselves by the way that we look. And God oftentimes tells us that He's looking at the inner man. And to make that our primary ambition, what is my conduct? What is my heart? What's going on the inside of me? And so what's happening externally may be consistent with that, but maybe it won't be. And so the Bible repeatedly speaks to the fact that we should focus predominantly on the heart and on our conduct. Now, there's always balance here. Does this mean that we don't care at all about the way that we look or the way that we present ourselves? No, because the way that we present ourselves should be reflective and consistent with what it is that's happening inside of us. The point is, moving from the inside to the outside is the pathway that God would have us do it. Now, this focus on the inner man, I believe this is why God's law is no longer written on stone, but it is now written on hearts. It isn't an outward impression, it's an inner impression written on the heart. I believe this is also why, according to Romans 2 and Colossians 2, circumcision is no longer physical, but the true circumcision is that of the heart done by the Holy Spirit. So the physical marking externally may be consistent with what's inside, but maybe it isn't. And so we should be considerate in that way. The last principle, and again, this, you know, it was a young person that asked this question. It is a good question to ask. Your body is not your own. Remember that. And God warns against excessive attention drawn to ourselves. You know the passage about don't let your adornment be the braiding of your hair and the putting on of jewelry and gold and those kinds of things, but let it be the imperishable beauty of this inner spirit that God sees. God says this. So God does address the external factor to a degree. Lastly, the third principle to guide us is that the Bible says much about being slow to decisions. So Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 2, Let me just read this. Proverbs 19 and verse 2. Desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way. So you can just think about the person that maybe on a whim, just runs off to Las Vegas for the weekend, has some partying times, goes into a tattoo parlor and says, "Hey, I want you to put, a picture of Mickey Mouse or something on my arm," or something like that. Decisions made in haste are usually not good decisions. Now, maybe there's some here. I would imagine there are probably some here who would say, "Yeah, I made decisions in haste when I was young, and I regret them." But that's just something to consider. I will just tell you, me personally, when I was in my early 20s, and I have no judgment for anyone with tattoos. If you make your decision based on these biblical principles, there was a time where I was very much considering getting one. I had a design laid out, and I just kept thinking about it, Yeah, I did. I wrote it up myself. It was while I was in art school. And it would have been, I think, a meaningful one. It was something about Romans 1:16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus. And I considered it, just kept thinking about it long term, and for a long time thought, yeah, I definitely want this. I'm now approaching my late 30s. I'll be 37 next month. At this point in my life, I'm glad that I didn't. I'm now beyond that, and I didn't make that decision. If I did, my life would probably be no different. I would still be the same me. It wouldn't make a difference. But the point is, in permanent decisions, be very careful about making the decision in haste. I remember hearing this story years ago, and this is not about tattoos. This is actually about sexuality. But I do think it fits. There's this story of these young teenage girls, four of them, that were somewhat of the popular persuasion in high school, and they said, "Let's go and let's just make a pact that we're all going to together lose our virginity." So they went and proceeded with that. Came back the next week, and they said, so three of them were telling their stories, and then one of them said, "I did not." And the few were beginning to make fun of this one who didn't for the fact that she didn't. And she said to them, "What you have right now, I could have at any point for the rest of my life. But what I have, you can never again have," which was her purity at that point. It's a powerful statement about being very considerate of the decisions that we make in our youth. So, number three, how do dinosaurs fit in the Bible? So we're all over the map tonight in these questions. How do dinosaurs fit in the Bible? I believe very simply. I believe that God made this world in 6 days. It says so in Genesis. The people of God believed this forever. And I don't think that there is good reason to accept the timeline framing that was made by necessity of people who wrote off and considered it a foregone conclusion that the world was created by a miracle of God. The timeline and the time framing of millions and billions of years was one that was conjured up based on the presupposition that the world couldn't have been made with a miracle. And then we sometimes adopt that timeline. I don't think there's good reason to. I believe that the Bible is very express and very specific in its genealogical records. It speaks of Adam, and it goes to painstaking lengths to speak of Adam all the way down to Noah, all the way down to Abraham, all the way down ultimately to Jesus Christ, where there's really good reason to stand on the validity of that. It's not presenting this as hyperbole. It's presenting this as a literal history. So I believe God made the world in 6 days because he said it. I believe it because all of God's people have always believed it. And I believe it because there's even good, reasonable reasons to believe it. But in the book of Genesis, it says that God made, so in Genesis chapter 1, on the fifth and the sixth days of creation, God made all of the beasts and the fish of the sea and the birds of the air. In the fifth and the sixth days of creation, just before making man. In Job chapter 40, verses 15 through 24, Job describes a creature that I believe is very consistent with a dinosaur. You know the term behemoth. And, you know, there have been some who have tried to pigeonhole this creature as a, you know, it's a hippopotamus or something like that. Have you ever gone and seen a hippopotamus in real life? How many have seen one? Okay. A lot of us. I was on a safari several years ago in Africa, and at night, there's just this, I was in a tent, and right outside the tent was this womp, 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 this just really weird sound. I was like, what in the world is that? It was a hippo. So they make really weird noises, and they come up out of the water at night. We saw a ton of them, and this is what happens when modern liberal scholarship doesn't want to accept the direct terms given in Scripture. They try really hard to find some way to fit this in. Well, Job describes this creature as being one that you do not mess with because of its size, its bones being of iron and bronze, and its you know, the sinews of its skin being you know, webbed together and somewhat descriptive of scales. It speaks of it having a tail that is like a cedar tree, that is strong and powerful. Have you seen a hippo's tail? It's more like a pine cone than a cedar tree. There's nothing to write home about that tail. That doesn't fit. And again, this is what happens when we try to just not take it at face value. So I don't accept the timeline of the evolutionists. I accept the timeline of young earth creationists. There's a lot of really good stuff there. I believe that there's a reason why, you know, dinosaurs supposedly lived 65 million years ago. They are repeatedly finding dinosaur bones that they, at first it happened accidentally, that they accidentally broke into them, but dinosaur bones with malleable, soft tissues inside of them, including soft and pliable blood vessels. So you're telling me this bone is supposedly 65 million years old, which is an unimaginably long period of time, and yet the inside of it still has soft tissues? Why are there people all through the ages in much more recent history who have described giant lizards that terrorize people? I'm just saying, the narrative that we are forced to believe and that we're pressured to believe and that we are told to be fools if we don't just accept it, I don't do that. I don't like doing that. I don't like being forced into that. I'm going to take God and what he says. He has continually been redeemed in what he says. Anytime someone tries to push against it, he is redeemed always. So I believe that dinosaurs fit into the Bible very well. They were created along with people, and they were brought onto the ark along with Noah. And so they died much more recently. There is, in fact, a footprint, I believe it's at Dinosaur Valley State Park, where there is a footprint and a dinosaur footprint impressed together in the same mud, and the impression was made at the same time. They can tell based on their I don't know what technology they use to kind of get a photograph of the layering of it, but these impressions were made at the same time, human and a dinosaur at the same time. So I believe humans and dinosaurs walked together. And then lastly, will there be animals in heaven? My answer to this is I have no clue. But I wouldn't write it off. And the reason why, I have spoken a little bit about this. I am a proponent and a believer in and a teacher in the renewed earth eschatology, the belief that God is going to take everything corrupted in this world and bring it back to its restored state. I believe Romans 8 is talking about all of the creation being subject to the curse and all of the creation wanting to be set free from it. And so I would not be surprised if when we get to heaven and are in paradise, there are all these amazing creatures that glorify God. But beyond that, I have absolutely no idea. Whatever it is, it will be glorious. It will be awesome. We are marching toward that day, and I can't wait for it. And so let us work together to keep each other faithful on that journey. If you have any need at all, you can let it be known while we stand and while we sing.